session number 8276, Reel 1.
Mr. Nelson, Reel 1. In the early part of 1944, Mr. Nelson, you were involved in the famous Great Escape from Stalag Luft 3. Can you tell me in detail about your memories of that, of the part you played in it?
Yes, I'll try to give you what I remember of an event that took place quite a long time ago. I was taken prisoner in 1942 and arrived in Stalag Luft 3 in, I believe, November of 1942. And the number of prisoners that were coming in was increasing, and the Germans were obliged to expand the camp. And originally, when I arrived at the camp, there were just two compounds, one for officers and one for non-commissioned officers. New compounds were built, and we were moved in the spring of 1943 into a new compound, which became known later as the North Compound. The old compound that we'd moved out of became known as the Central Compound. The non-commissioned officers were moved out and it became exclusively an officer prison camp. And subsequently other compounds were built. But moving into a new compound, this gave opportunities for escape because, of course, it was a new terrain and avenues of escape in this particular compound had not been fully explored. The camp itself was typical type of camp with the normal type of barbed wire perimeter with what we used to call goon boxes, German watchtowers with searchlights and machine guns and so on. And the camp itself had been built in what was originally a pine forest, and it was built on a sandy soil. The pine trees had been cleared and wooden huts had been built inside this barbed wire perimeter. The fact that it was on sandy soil was considered, I believe, by the Germans to make it difficult from a tunnelling operation. But that was really just one of the things that had to be overcome. And in the camp there were a very varied number of prisoners. Some had been prisoners of war for a number of times with quite a considerable experience on escaping methods. Some had escaped and been recaptured. And also, in an officer's prison camp where you were not allowed to work, to go out to work, you were obliged to stay in the camp, escaping activity gave an opportunity of sort of occupational therapy. With a group of men like this, of course, they came from all sorts of professions and trades. So there were all sorts of specialists in all sorts of different types of activity, which, of course, was fully utilised as far as the escaping activity was concerned. It was partly through this that I was invited, about the time we moved to the new camp, by the escaping committee, which was a highly organised thing, under the authority of the senior British officer, and the chief of the escaping committee was an officer called Squadron Leader, who was well known, I'll remember, sorry, straight on. Were the chief of the escape committee, known as X, the X committee, and Big X was Squadron Leader Roger Bushell, who was a South African actually, and he was a barrister, a very capable organiser. Well, anyway, I was invited by some of the escape committee to join in this activity, largely because I think I was an engineer, basically, by profession, and although I was trained as a pilot and was captured as a bomber pilot, but I was then involved in helping with any kind of mechanical engineering type of activity that was necessary. All this had to be done, of course, utilizing very primitive homemade tools and any materials that came to hand, which made it much more difficult. But the tunnels that were envisaged, there were three of them, codenamed Tom, Dick and Harry, and they were made 30 feet deep, and they had to be shored with wood 100% because of the sand and the possibility of the tunnel collapsing, of course. And because of this, it was necessary to have air pumps and all sorts of devices that we developed as we went along in order to make the tunnelling on a fairly sophisticated basis a viable proposition. So I was involved with a number of other people in this type of activity. There were some people, mostly, of course, people who'd had previous experience of actual digging tunnels. Other people were dealing with forging documents in preparation for the ultimate escape, preparing clothes, and there were a huge number of people who were involved who never actually saw the tunnel itself, but they were on the security side of things. They were known as stooges, who kept watch on the Germans to make sure that the secret nature of the tunnel was didn't become apparent to the Germans. The Germans, of course, were very well experienced themselves in counter-tunnelling activity, and they had some specialised people whom they called ferrets, and they used to search the camp day and night in order to look for any kind of escaping activity that went on. So while any activity of this sort was carried out by the prisoners, one had to have quite an elaborate organisation in order to watch the Germans while work was in progress and close down rapidly and so on. So the ancillary organisation was very considerable. I think there were more than 500 people involved in activities like the activity that I was involved in the preparation. Initially, there was no guarantee at all that one would be given an opportunity to escape. From the outset, it was foreseen that even with three tunnels going, that the possibility of getting 500 people out was a rather remote possibility. But I think in the initial stages, it was thought that if it were successful, there may perhaps be up to 100 or something of that kind. But there was no selection at all in the early stages, so that we all worked towards this tunnelling activity because it was we considered it was our duty to escape. It was the type of activity that, the only type of activity that appeared to have a future to it. We all did a certain amount of studying, and we had an opportunity to read. We had quite a good library provided through Red Cross facilities. But all this type of activity was an activity that one felt had limited future to it, because we were very conscious that you were locked up in this prison camp and you were anxious to get out. Lots of things were happening outside the camp, and although you read and see films nowadays and it all appears to be very exciting, in actual fact, for the most part, it was deadly dull. And of course, we were nearly always hungry and so on, and the more exercise you took, the more hungry you were. So I'm just explaining that point of view, that the 500 workers were feeling that they were working towards something that, even if it was rather remote, offered some future prospect. So the work started, and they decided to build three tunnels simultaneously, mainly from the point of view that if one was discovered, they would still have other possibilities remaining. And this proved ultimately to be a wise arrangement. As I mentioned, I think, earlier, the tunnels were made in the sand quite deep initially. Shafts were sunk down to about 30 feet below the surface level. The reason for this was mainly because the tunnels had to be shored anyway, and if they were too close to the ground, any movement on the surface, even, say, carts or anything of that kind moving over the surface, were liable to collapse the tunnel. It had to be shored, and therefore it was better to be at lower level. And furthermore, the Germans had special listening devices all around the perimeter wires, which picked up any indication of tunnelling activity at fairly close below the surface. It was considered that 30 feet it would be below these listening devices, although when the tunnels arrived there, special precautions were taken to minimise the sound. But these are the reasons why the tunnel was made as deep as it was. So a shaft was sunk vertically about 30 feet, and then there were three chambers were made in the sides of the tunnel. A ladder went down to the tunnel, and then from the fourth side the tunnel started. The tunnel was, the size of the tunnel was quite small, because of course the larger the tunnel, the more earth you've got to remove, and dispersal, as I'll mention later, dispersal of earth was one of the major problems. But the size of the tunnel, I think, was, as I recall, was about 55 centimetres square. It wasn't actually square, it was trapezoidal, but that was only for strength, that's a minor point. And because it was sand, it had to be shored 100% with wood, which we had to scrounge by taking huts and beds and everything else within the camp to pieces, bit by bit, surreptitiously, so that the German security organisation wouldn't notice any change. The actual tunnelling process was that they built a framework, and then you'd have a tunneller would be working in the tunnel, and he would then dig ahead within the security of this shoring, and the whole thing would then collapse in an arch. And then the surplus sand, as it was moved back behind him, and shoring would be put in, and then it would have to pack around it, you see. So it was a very laborious process.
Pack around it how?
Well, by putting in a framework and then building up the frame and packing behind the frame.
With sand?
With sand, yes, with the sand that had collapsed. But, you see, it was then... It depended on the actual nature of it, whether it was wet or not. But frequently it involved this business where you had collapses, and then you had to work within the tunnel itself and then clear the soil back and quite frequently build up in order to get support behind the shoring. And this applied particularly, of course, when eventually we got to the end of the tunnel and then had to go vertically upwards. But because of the small cross-sectional area of the tunnel, it was not possible, actually. You see, the length of an ordinary thigh bone is more than the length of the tunnel, or at least from the knee to the back. You couldn't kneel down in the tunnel. You had to move along the tunnel on your elbows and on your toes, which was a very uncomfortable way of moving along. And at various points, eventually the tunnels, I mentioned there were three tunnels. I don't know whether you would like me to go into detail of all three. It would be rather prolonged if I did, but I'm generalising in a sense between the three at the moment. But common feature of the three were that at certain stages they built what they called a halfway house, a sort of staging post, which was made on a larger diameter. The reason for this was you could get people could pass in the tunnel. and if anybody wanted to get out, you see, you could turn around, so to speak, because you couldn't turn around in the tunnel in the ordinary way. So there were these enlarged sections known as halfway houses or staging posts or whatever, made along the tunnels. Just briefly, I'll mention the point about the three tunnels. The one tunnel, known as Dick, was the most advanced initially, and in the summer of 1943, we had American officers, Air Force officers, in the camp with us, and a considerable number of working on this tunnel scheme. And then, because of large numbers of prisoners coming in, particularly Americans at that stage, the Germans decided to build additional compounds and were moving the Americans into separate compounds. And the Americans were all moved out in, I think it was September of 1943. And to enable the Americans who had been working on the tunnels to have a chance to escape, work was pressed on with Dick much faster than was wise from a security point of view, in order to satisfy this requirement of trying to give the Americans a chance before they left the compound. And as a result of this, the Germans became suspicious. Now, in the ordinary course of events, everything would be quietened down to lull the suspicions, but because of the time factor in relation to the American officer's departure, it was pressed on, and eventually the Germans suspected there was a tunnel, and ultimately, through quite elaborate process of elimination and searching, they found the tunnel, and Dick was blown up, actually, quite a spectacular explosion which blew a hole through the roof of the hut, as it was where the shaft was. The shaft of the tunnel was like a gun in effect, and the explosive blew half the roof off that particular part of the hut. Now, that was Dick, and that was the end of it, and the Americans left. So the next tunnel, this is where the point I'd mentioned earlier came into effect, the rather foresighted planning of the ex-committee under Squadron Leader Bushell, where the Germans found this. Of course, everything was quietened down for a while. Well, there was a tremendous uproar, of course, initially, but then when it died down, the Germans felt that, well, that they'd nipped the tunnelling activity in the bud, because it was quite an elaborate tunnel and they'd never seen anything quite like it. But furthermore, the winter was coming on, when winter tended to be rather a close season, both from outside the wire and inside. There was little prospect, so the generally speaking, activity died down, and the Germans were more relaxed, and it was, from that point of view, a better opportunity to go ahead with long-term plans. And the long-term plan was to finish the second tunnel, which was Harry, by the spring of the following year, 1944. And so as soon as possible, from a security point of view, the tunnelling proceeded on Harry. And this developed eventually to, it was finally the one through which the escape took place. So it was completed. It was the only one of the three that was actually completed. And this was the one where we had the halfway houses and the sign that I'd mentioned earlier. I've mentioned the question of the earth and the sand, rather, and the removal of it. I also mentioned the difficulty of moving along the tunnel. So in an early stage, we decided to build a railway of sorts. This is where I became involved in my particular activity, because I had to design the railroad and the rolling stock from very limited resources, and it was all rather crude, but it was actually quite effective. We laid the rails from wooden strips that came from The huts were prefabricated and they'd been built in sections, and they had large lat-type wood over the joint, where we removed these, back one from each room, and used these for rails, built along the floor of the tunnel and attached, of course, to the bottom frame. And the trolleys were made up, they were wooden frame. We used hardwood that we got from sort of chairs, I think, in order to make the main structure of the trolley, with bearings cut in the beach. And we got tubes, metal pipes, from, it was the front rail of the cooking stoves that were in the huts, that we used as axles for the trolley. And we then had to make the wheels by making them up from wood on cutting a circular portion from a plank, and then making it up with about three or four pieces of plank, each of them cut in a circle, with one larger to form a flange, and then holes were drilled through the centre, of course, and these axles were put through and bent, split open, bent around, and then the wheels were bolted together, and the wheels and axles rotated in wooden bearings, and proved to be very strong, so much so that we not only were we able to use them to evacuate the sand, we had removable wooden small hopper type of thing, which were filled with sand and then put on, you see, and two of these were put on the trolleys. But the trolleys were sufficient not only to carry the sand, but could carry a tunneler. And you lay full length on this thing, and we had rope, plaited string, made up into ropes, and you'd have someone in a halfway house would be hauling, and there was a string on either end, so it could be hauled either way. But by this means, both the sand could be evacuated quite quickly and effectively, and furthermore, the workers and so on could go up on the lying flat on these trolleys and come back and be hauled along. And these trolleys also were used during the escape, which of course speeded up the escaping quite considerably, when you'd got to get a lot of people through this tunnel, and many of the people had never been in the tunnel before and tended to suffer from claustrophobia, so just laying on a tunnel helped them. Laying on the trolley in the tunnel and being hauled along was very much easier than going a considerable distance, and the final distance of Harry was I think about between 300 and 350 feet, if I remember rightly correctly. And to do that on toes and elbows would have been, particularly if you're carrying kit and things like that, would have been virtually impossible. So that was one little element that was sophisticated. Relatively sophisticated. It was quite crude, really, but I mean, it was in relation to tunnelling and the limited means available, it was relatively sophisticated. The pumps also were, I think, quite ingenious. I was involved in making the pumps and helping design them and modify designs using whatever materials we had. The basic principle was using kit bags, ordinary army kit bags, and having two of them, and then having a valve box. The original valves were made with leather flaps, usually reinforced with a piece of a tin can cut to shape, and this flap would open or close as necessary, according to whether it was being suction or blown. And the two kit bags were arranged on a wooden frame and then operated by someone who pulled this frame backwards and forwards. And when one kit bag opened up, that would be a suction stroke, and the other one would collapse, that would be delivery, and then it would reverse. You then get delivery and suction, you see. So it was a double-acting arrangement on each stroke. You had one bag sucking, one bag delivering. The suction line was arranged through... We had in Red Cross parcels tin cans, and we had a Canadian can which was made, was powdered milk, called Klim, K-L-I-M, which is reverse of milk, M-I-L-K. And these, it was very good milk, incidentally, and these tins were very good, and with a tin opener you could, the top would come off, and then with a tin opener you could take the bottom out, and they would make up into a very good pipeline. And the suction line came down the shaft of the tunnel, and from the top of the shaft of the tunnel it was usually taken to some convenient place where you could get a good fresh air supply, but where it was away from any noise element, because the trouble was that these tins transmitted sound, and flapping of the valves and so on was quite a consideration. So you get the suction down like that. Then the delivery went on a similar pipeline made with Klim tins down the, buried in the floor of the tunnel underneath the frame, and then came up, and it was extended as the tunnel extended. So there was a fresh air supply going in at the working face. The bad air was pushed back towards the tunnel. It tended to rise in the tunnel, and there was an outlet, again on a piped outlet, which went to the nearest chimney. The reason for this was that it was very moist air, and if you had the outlet pipe in a visible position, you'd get a condensation trail, so to speak, which could be visible. So the outlet went into a chimney, and from that point of view it wasn't seen. It also had another rather ingenious arrangement, because by going into the chimney you had a natural ventilation, and the pumps were arranged with a bypass, so that when the tunnel was not in operation, the bypass was left open, and then you would then get a suction on the outlet, which would then create a draft right through from the inlet, right down through the pump to the working face and back, and there was a natural ventilation went on at the tunnel face when no work was in progress, and this was a tremendous advantage.